Speaking of liberty, the National Broadcasting Company presents another in a special series of programs under the auspices of the Council for Democracy. There was free talk in the old New England town hall and around the Cracker Barrel in the Crossroads store. And there's free talk by free men every week at this time on the air, led by our host, Rex Stout. Many of you already know Rex Stout as the author of Baffling Mystery Stories, as the brain parent of the distinguished criminologist Nero Wolfe. On this program, you will get to know him even better as an outspoken champion of our American democracy, Mr. Stout.
Thank you, George Hicks. Good evening, friends of liberty. Here's a question. How completely can civil liberties be preserved in a democracy? Or to put it the other way, how much of them must be surrendered in a time of national emergency? We do legally have them. They are embedded in our Constitution and the Bill of Rights. They do not belong to our Congress or our President or even our Supreme Court. They belong to us. Should they be permanently impaired or injured by any process whatever, we are to blame. Then we must eternally guard them. But in guarding them from an external menace, is it or is it not necessary to permit their temporary suspension within our borders? I'm putting that question to an expert, Bertrand Russell. Supporter of conscientious objectors in the last war, determined champion of democracy in this one, Mr. Russell is a world-famous mathematician, philosopher, social scientist, and author of many books, among them Power and Freedom versus Organization. What do you say to my question, Mr. Russell?
I can suggest the answer, perhaps, Mr. Stout, by mentioning a letter I received a short time ago from a young man who objected to the reduction of his ego in a training camp.
What was the matter? Was the sergeant rude to him?
The young man wrote me that in his view, military discipline was essentially undemocratic. And I wrote back that I felt he was quite wrong. I pointed out that only a disciplined army can be effective, and that in these days, only a thoroughly disciplined army can defend democracy. I also pointed out that an army is not undemocratic if it is ordered into being by democratic authority, and if it allows as great a degree of democracy as is compatible with success in war.
Alexander Wilkett made that point on this program a few weeks ago.
I heard him, and I agreed with him. And that, I think, is part of the answer to your question, Mr. Stout. When a nation is in danger, some of the liberties that are possible in quiet times have to be surrendered. If the danger is very great, additional curbs may be necessary till the time of crisis is ended.
Maybe that's what bothered the boy and his ego at camp. If the national purpose is the preservation of freedom, he might have felt it was contradictory to curtail his own freedom in a training camp.
That same sense of contradiction and conflict is in many men's minds. Believe me, when we think about military necessity, we are impressed with the need of restrictions. But when we think about the objects for which we are contending, we wish the restrictions to be as few and as temporary as possible. It is very easy to go too far in either direction, Mr. Stout. But it is not easy to find a way of preserving liberties that are harmless and remembering at the same time that liberty for all mankind is the ultimate goal.
It shouldn't be too difficult. After all, if we're fighting for democracy, we've got to keep our own democratic processes fairly healthy, even during the crisis. And any sensible man understands that we have to make certain sacrifices for the sake of efficiency.
People are not always so reasonable. One of the difficulties of preserving liberty in time of danger is that danger stimulates hatred and fear, which often take unwise forms and are apt to produce quite needless intolerance. Do you know it is actually said that when England was at war with France just after the French Revolution, Wordsworth and Coleridge were arrested as fifth columnists?
Wordsworth and Coleridge, they weren't even columnists. What were they caught doing?
They were overheard talking about a spy, Spinoza. When they explained that they had been discussing the philosopher Spinoza, no one believed them, because no one in the neighborhood had ever heard of him.
And of course, if they were talking about a person no one had ever heard of, that made them suspicious characters anyhow.
Oh, of course. A variation of a well-known phenomenon. The feeling that uniformity of opinion and effort is vital in an emergency tends to create a sort of unreasoning and quite unfair suspicion of minority groups, even if they are completely loyal. One of the most odious features of Hitlerism is its treatment of Jews. The Nazis use anti-Semitism as a weapon and are constantly injecting it in their comments on America and skillfully utilizing it as a means of creating disunity here. This attack on one of the fundamental principles of freedom must be recognized and thwarted. Intolerance is dangerously inconsistent with the goal of liberty.
Nothing is more fundamentally anti-democratic, or actually more uncivilized.
Say rather illiberal. Democracy, unfortunately, is not incompatible with persecution, as the history of the early New England colonists shows. Another thing we must be on our guard against, if we wish to preserve our freedom, is optimistic propaganda. The dictatorships are supreme at that sort of thing. Not that it is confined to the dictatorships alone, but simply that they do it more thoroughly. After all, it's very easy to slip into the habit of believing what is pleasant and encouraging. If we mean to combat the dictatorships, we must learn to endure the truth, even if it is unpalatable. We must insist that our governments tell us the truth and not soften us with optimistic lies. An unreal optimism on the part of the government is not the best way to stimulate effort in a brave nation.
Well, Winston Churchill certainly knows that. He knows that a brave and free people are ready and willing to provide the blood, sweat, and tears if you confront them with the need and don't lie to them.
Yes. At the same time, the question of telling people the truth brings up the problem of military censorship. There must be censorship, naturally. Military necessity limits what can be told. We cannot afford to give aid and comfort to the enemy. But military censorship must not be made the excuse for preventing wholesome political debate or for concealing, except for short periods, failure and incompetence in high places.
No, the news of ship movements must be suppressed, but Congress should never be prevented from inquiring into production tangles, for example, or investigating the desirability of a separate air force.
Exactly, Mr. Stout.
Well, going back to our bone, Mr. Russell, can you suggest any particular things that we as individuals can do to preserve as much liberty as may be?
First of all, we should not acquiesce in unjust attacks upon groups that there is no reason to think disloyal. I met a man recently who assured me that he had no race prejudices, and then he went on to say that he never trusted a Filipino. I know nothing of Filipinos, but I couldn't help being amused by his inconsistency.
Now, we often meet people who distrust all the Irish or all the English or all the Jews or all the Confucianists.
It's irrational and dangerous, Mr. Stout. We must fight against it in ourselves as well as in others, because in it lies the germ of persecution. For example, one must not, in opposing Hitler, fall into the error of hating all Germans. We oppose the German government and the Nazis, but after the war, we hope for a government representing the better Germans, with whom it will be possible to cooperate. Then, to continue with efforts we can make as individuals to preserve our liberties, we can refuse to be too credulous. In time of excitement, as I suggested a moment ago, men are prone to believe what suits their case, even if the evidence is very slight. Rival groups each assert, quite positively, totally different things.
And prove them with their own special polls of public opinion.
A good cause has no need of falsehood, and rival untruths make democratic cooperation very difficult.
Often nearly impossible. What else do you suggest, Mr. Russell?
We must not jump to the conclusion that people who disagree with us are wicked. You know, that's a very common error that honest people fall into, Mr. Stout. The argument to one's conscience runs something like this. I say to myself that my view of the matter is right. It must be right, because I believe in it so thoroughly, and because my reasons are so obviously valid. Therefore, anyone who disagrees with me cannot be disagreeing on logical grounds, because logic and reason are on my side. Plainly, he is a scoundrel, serving the devious ends.
Well, I don't know about sarcasm. People who disagree with me usually are scoundrels. There's just no convincing them.
Dear me, Mr. Stout, how very distressing. Well, all you can do is to state your case convincingly in the belief that if your opponents are honest, as most of them really are, they are quite as likely to be moved by good arguments as you yourself.
I don't know. I'll try, but I don't know. What else can we do to preserve our individual liberties?
One last thing. We must not attribute perfection to anything that exists. In defending democracy, we must not be merely defensive. We have also to aim at creating a more perfect democracy. We must not have a sort of mental Maginot line where old beliefs stand in static defense. Unless we have in view something better than the present, we shall fail to generate the necessary energy to carry on the struggle to final victory.
But what is better than the present? What will be? An all-inclusive world federation?
No, not at first, and not exactly that. I assume, for the purpose of the argument, that Britain and her allies will win, and I trust that the peace imposed on the enemy will provide for temporary complete disarmament, but not for either indemnities or reparations. Following the peace, I believe the best interest of democracy can be served to begin with by an Anglo-American alliance for world cooperation.
America isn't even in the war. How can she dictate any part of the peace?
Whether or not America ever enters the war, she cannot stay out of the peace. Just think a moment. When everything is finished and all the armies and air fleets have gone home or been destroyed, America will be the most powerful single nation in the world. With her assistance, everything can be done. Without it, nothing.
What sort of alliance do you visualize?
An Anglo-American alliance for peace and democracy, which other nations who feel as we do will be invited to join.
Another League of Nations?
Yes, but on a different pattern. To guarantee its authority, I should recommend centralizing all military and civil aviation in an international air force, which could react when necessary against any aggressor.
Well, who would decide when an aggression has been committed?
An international body of jurists, taken from every member nation.
And why would other nations want to join this alliance? Would there be any force or pressure applied?
No force. I visualize low tariff barriers between member states to create economic advantages. I also imagine that members of the alliance would refuse to export any raw materials, whatever, to any outsider, if such raw materials could be put to military uses.
But what about Germany and her allies? Would they be permanent outsiders?
Germany, as a defeated enemy, would be kept disarmed at first. But I should suggest that no bars be raised against her chances of winning back economic prosperity, because prosperity makes for contentment. Also, the Germans, ever since the days of Bismarck, have been energetic and efficient and ambitious. They cannot be kept permanently outlawed. And we cannot forget that a victorious democracy would have great prestige with German non-Nazis. I should say that Germany should be admitted to the World Alliance, but only after she had qualified for membership by becoming truly democratic, by eliminating the undesirable doctrines of Nazism, and by changing her educational system to conform to the political and social ideals of the democracies.
That's a large order, Mr. Russell.
We are engaged in a large and desperate struggle, Mr. Stout. But however large and engrossing it becomes, we cannot afford to let our ideals and our hopes be submerged. Whatever comes, we must keep our eyes on the future. We must remember that if freedom is to be preserved by fighting for it, we must do our utmost individually and collectively. We must keep what liberties we can in the face of danger and realize that those that we surrender temporarily, we surrender for the common good. And finally, our leaders must be so guided by public opinion that they devote their power and authority when war is ended to an extension of true democracy over all the world.
Thank you, Mr. Russell. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest today is Bertrand Russell. This is Rex Stout saying goodbye until next week.
You've just heard the 15th of a special series of programs entitled Speaking of Liberty, brought to you each week by the National Broadcasting Company in cooperation with the Council for Democracy, a national organization dedicated to the propagation of an American faith in democracy. Next week, Rex Stout will bring Ernest Hauser to the microphone. A copy of the script of this broadcast will be mailed free to anyone requesting it. Please address your letter or card to the Council for Democracy, 285 Madison Avenue, New York City. To the Council for Democracy at 285 Madison Avenue, New York City. And next week, Mr. Stout will bring Ernest Hauser to the microphone. Speaking of Liberty has been presented as a public service by NBC and the independent radio stations associated with the Red Network of the National Broadcasting Company.